Hi, welcome to Neuroverse, a podcast hosted by Carolina
and Clara, where we discuss all matters from neuroscience to philosophy and beyond.
Today's episode is on chronic stress. And this episode was actually requested by one of you guys, one of our listeners. So do let us know what episodes you'd like to see us do next, and we will definitely check them out. And also, I think this topic is, of course, relevant for all of us. And right now, I'm entering my summer break, and I really wanted to consciously try and take a bit more of control of the stress in my life. So it was really insightful reading all about the effects that stress has on your body.
Yeah, it was a really good opportunity to learn about something new. So thank you for suggesting this topic.
Yes. So stress is a physical response, and this comes from our evolution and having dealt with immediate danger in the wild, such as having a threat towards a lion. And now we live in a modern society where we don't encounter lions as much, but we encounter other things such as traffic and work and relationship problems, illnesses, and many other concerns that we have with our life. And they still cause the same physiological responses in our body. And so there's two different types of responses to stress. There is first immediate response, which activates your sympathetic nervous system. And this is unconscious. There is a hormonal release of epinephrine and norepinephrine. And your pupils dilate, your heart rate increases, your breathing increases, your bronchioles relax so that you can inhale more air. And this is all related to that quick physiological response that you need to have if you were to run away from danger. So you get more oxygen to your muscles. These hormones that you release inhibits your salivation because you're not meant to be digesting food while you're running away from a lion. And it also inhibits squeezing of peristalsis of the stomach, so you don't digest, and it also inhibits the secretion of digestive enzymes. And it also causes you to release more glucose, so you have more energy. So all of this is a first response, immediate response to a stressful situation. And so stress is a physiological response, but the response that we have are to stressors. And as I mentioned, way back in the day, these stressors would be wild boars and dangers of that sort. And nowadays we have different types of stressors, and stressors are, according to psychological literature, our perception. So the negative connotation that we have with quote unquote stressors that lead to our physiological response has a very intertwined mental component to it. And then there's a second response, which is delayed. It's unconscious. And it involves the hormonal release of cortisol. So it starts off in the brain, in the amygdala, where your perceived sense of danger then sends a signal to the hypothalamic pituitary axis, HPA, which then it secretes corticosteroid releasing factor, which stimulates the pituitary and the adrenal glands, which then release cortisol. And cortisol is a stress hormone, and it's needed for everyday processes. We start off with more cortisol in the morning. It's also involved in our circadian rhythms, but it's also involved in this second delayed response, which I mentioned. And this is more the type of stress that is not immediate, but it's prolonged. So like work stress, relationship stress, caregiving stress, where burnout has a higher likelihood because of the chronic aspect of this type of response. So all of these physiological responses are beneficial within a time frame, but when they become chronic, they're not as beneficial. So cortisol keeps your high rate and glucose levels elevated. Cortisol releases more sugar, so you're constantly breaking down the energy in your body, you're breaking down the fats. And if it has no more fat to break down from, it starts to break down bone, which we can already start to think of the potential diseases involved, such as arthritis. And then cortisol is also shown to increase inflammation. And as I mentioned, it's good in one sense. You know, if you get bitten, if you have a cut, you want to have an inflammatory response to protect yourself from these infections. But of course, when you have chronic stress and you're chronically producing cortisol, this then leads to adverse situations.
I read that the acute stress response leads to like pro-inflammation, like you said, which helps to, you know, destroy antigens or pathogens when presented with stress. But cortisol then has anti-inflammatory effects to prevent tissue damage that's associated with inflammation. So I guess it sort of balances each other out. But then with chronic stress, it's hypothesized that cortisol may also then obtain additional pro-inflammatory functions instead of anti-inflammatory functions.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, so one of the examples where a chronic inflammatory state is negative is autoimmune diseases such as rheumatological disorders, rheumatoid arthritis, and lupus. And also, they did this interesting study where they vaccinated medical students during exam season versus a control group that weren't medical students or in exam season, but the age range was the same and gender was the same. And they noticed that those that were vaccinated when they were stressed during the exam season didn't uptake to the vaccine, so they didn't respond to the vaccine. And so not only you have a prolonged inflamed state, you're not responding to vaccinations. There is also a lower resistance to infection. And so as you can see, like all of these different factors are adding up, which obviously can develop into more serious conditions. You can't heal wounds as well. And also you don't apoptose cancer cells as efficiently as you would outside of these chronic stress conditions. So risks of having cancer and many other diseases as well as infections is much higher.
Yeah, I find it really interesting how intertwined it all is, like how stress can have all these influences on the inflammatory system, but inflammation also leads to a stress response, and it's just all interconnected. Another really interesting aspect of chronic stress and specifically cortisol that I came across was its link to sleep. So like you mentioned, there are diurnal rhythms of cortisol in the body where levels are higher in the morning and lower throughout the day. Yeah. Higher in the morning to help with arousal and making us feel awake, and then they decrease throughout the day. But there was this review and meta-analysis of papers that looked at cortisol slope and how it's related to physical and emotional health. And so they looked at the cortisol slope as the change in cortisol levels from the morning to evening. And they showed that in every study that addressed this, which was a total of 80 studies, there was a significant association with poor emotional and physical health outcomes and a flatter cortisol slope. And so some examples from previous studies that associated the cortisol slope with poorer health included associations with depression, fatigue, cardiovascular disease, and mortality amongst cancer patients. But the effect size was largest for immune and inflammatory outcomes, which makes sense in the context of what you've described. But yeah, what I found fascinating was all of the variable probable explanations for this association, which they couldn't really come to a conclusion. But for example, they said there could be many different possibilities that explain the association, such as the dysregulation of the HPA axis leading to the diseases, which seems kind of obvious. But alternatively, stress could also initiate and maintain dysregulation of the circadian rhythm that contributes to flatter slopes and leads to the diseases. Or it could be the other way around, and it could be that symptoms and stress of the disease lead to HPA dysfunction over time, which is also likely because individuals that had more depression in their past had a flatter slope, but then having a flatter slope didn't necessarily predict you had depression. So it's that makes it seem likely that it's the disease that's leading to the dysregulation of the stress response. And then a fourth option is that another factor, an external factor like changes in inflammatory biology or dysregulation of circadian genes could cause both of these phenotypes, the flattening of the cortisol slopes and the pathophysiology of the disease at the same time. So it's just all so complicated how it's all related to each other.
Yeah, it sounds like a massive chicken and the egg problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Related to sleep, so coffee is a stimulant, and of course it also increases your stress response. If you are already in a state of chronic stress and you have these hormones going around, and then on top of that you have caffeine, it will put you in an even heightened stress condition. And of course that can affect your circadian rhythm, and so potentially having an effect not only on your physiological response, but also your cortical levels.
Yeah, and also a lot of mechanisms that counter stress occur during sleep, because parasympathetic activation that you mentioned is like the rest and digest system. And it all kind of, it's also when anabolic mechanisms help to repair the body. And I think whenever sleep is related, it's just so complex, because it's like the chicken and egg, like you said. But yeah, also funny you mentioned caffeine, because I was thinking about that when I was reading about stress for this episode this morning and drinking coffee and feeling really anxious about everything.
Yeah, actually, so that was something else. I'm trying to go one whole month minimum without having any coffee. I want to do like a full reset. Yeah.
Oh my God.
I know. which is why I was thinking, I wonder the effects coffee may have in terms of stress as well. So it was really insightful. And yeah, I definitely feel calmer.
Motivation for you to continue doing that then.
Yeah. Also, effects of chronic stress on the brain is, there's plenty of studies that shows that it has a decrease in concentration, memory, and even hippocampal density. So one of the effects of the first response is an increased arousal state, increased focus state. And this can then carry on to the second response when it also becomes chronic. And then when things become chronic, what originally start off as being positives, then there comes a flip side, like we mentioned, the inflammation. So from, on the one hand, being in an arousal and hyperattentive state to then having a poor memory and concentration. Also, as you mentioned, it can also then lead to depression or vice versa. And in terms of pain, so originally, you know, we know this, if we're in a situation that is stressful, we may not experience the pain in the first place. Like maybe we burn ourselves or cut ourselves, but because of our surroundings, we may not even feel it in the first place. But there's been studies that show that then it causes an increased perception in pain.
Chronic stress?
In chronic stress, yeah.
Yeah, it's so interesting, the dissonance of like the acute stress response and the chronic stress response are literally opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they did this study. So they use zebrafish a lot for looking at glucocorticoids signaling. And they mainly do it by following early life stress. And this can be done through like mild shocks or simply administering cortisol, and seeing how that affects the zebrafish in adulthood. Several studies show that then in adulthood, the zebrafish aren't able to produce appropriate cortisol levels for the surrounding response. So usually if they experience cortisol or are in a stress-related environment early on in life, then later on in life, they have a higher baseline of cortisol, and it's just not appropriate to the environment that they're in.
Mm.
Which is interesting. I think it also adds in like a time frame awareness that we should have in terms of like development.
Yeah, like a critical period for defining your baseline cortisol stress response.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there was this other study published in Cell by Schneider et al. That they were looking at the relationship between chronic stress and gut inflammation. So this has been a big question mark in the field. It's generally known that the gut is involved, as I mentioned, with the first response, you produce less digestive enzymes, etc. But they now are considering the idea that glucocorticoids act directly on immune cells, which respond by releasing molecules that cause inflammation. It has been shown that glucocorticoids cause glial cells to release molecules that trigger immune cells. and that these end up causing painful bowel inflammation. And this was surprising because it is, as you mentioned, this interesting paradox, because it is also glucocorticoids that cause gut inflammation, but they are also sometimes used to treat irritable bowel disorders. Yeah, it seems that the system shifts when it goes from being acute to chronic.
Yeah, I wonder why this happens, though, because it just doesn't really seem to make sense. Of course, I'm thinking of this evolutionarily, because that's always the way to give things in more insight. But yeah, I guess we were just not really made to deal with chronic stress. And so whereas the acute stress response, like you said, is very beneficial for running away from predators or surviving, basically. But I guess maybe because we weren't presented with chronic, we meaning like animals, weren't presented with chronic stress often, that no system was put in place to like deal with it.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe it also has something to do with like the development of the prefrontal cortex and stuff, because potentially it relates more, stressors are mental properties, you know, we associate stress with relationships and work problems and little things that I guess trigger us in life, and we are having that first initial super hyper inflammatory stress response, and then afterwards the baseline levels are still high. You know, I think there's a few episodes in which we cover this, where, for example, noise in the brain, where we talk a lot about how our current environment, we're constantly bombarded with stimuli, of course that will keep our cortisol levels high. And so yeah, I guess before we didn't have potentially so much of an abstract and conceptual idea of stuff that could cause us stress, and in the meantime we've managed to make some up.
But that's a really good point, because you're right, the prefrontal cortex, it provides a lot of the top-down information into the brain, so like contextual information and anything internally generated. And while that could contribute to creating our own stress and exacerbating chronic stress, it's also important to mention that once you have trauma in life, for example, and start to develop a chronic stress response, then you're also more likely to have stress when a stressor isn't really a stressor. And so while our prefrontal cortex has developed this ability to like give us stress in a way, to let us give ourselves our own stress, it's also the answer to chronic stress, which I think leads quite nicely into something I did want to touch upon as well, which we have discussed in previous episodes, like silence on the brain and breathing and the brain, and how these can help to increase our well-being. And so a lot of the approaches to chronic stress, I think, target the prefrontal cortex. For example, mindfulness, which I'm a huge supporter of as an intervention and treatment for chronic stress. And there was a really good review paper on this that I'll put in our show notes on our website, where they kind of, yeah, so they went over the potential psychological kind of mechanisms that mindfulness could do for treating chronic stress. And so they mentioned that mindfulness-based interventions improve the efficiency of executive attention during what is called conflict detection, which is when we have competing goals or action plans that we have to monitor, and we need to detect when control should be exerted. And so when we have stress and anxiety, the conflict detection becomes hyperactive and we feel lost and not in control. But mindfulness can improve our ability to exert control and accept attentional conflicts. So instead of just becoming helpless, we are able to make a decision and choose which information we want to prioritize or process. On that note, mindfulness training has also been shown to decrease our avoidance of negative or stressful stimuli, which is a bit paradoxical, but also makes a lot of sense. It's like how people joke about in therapy, you want to reaccount stressful memories or situations and approach them with your attention and with intention. And so, yeah, the mindfulness practices can basically decrease our attentional bias, which is the tendency to pay selective attention to potential threats. And so that's linked to what I said. if you have trauma, then you're also more likely to just view everything as a potential threat. But if you have attentional broadening, you can accept your traumatic memories as just a memory on its own and not necessarily label it as very, very negative, which will also lead to you not labeling things in general as negative. So this could put your stressor in a larger context that's less likely to lead to a stress response. And also it means that future potential stressors are less likely to lead to a stress response. And finally, stress can also lead to what's called rumination, which is a type of cognitive preservation that prolongs and exacerbates threat. So it's like when you continue to recount a stressful time and you just fixate on it. Mindfulness practices have been shown to decrease rumination by engaging inhibitory control mechanisms in the face of negative emotional information. So instead of, when you're presented with the negative information, instead of labeling it as negative and kind of ruminating, fixating on that, we have inhibitory control mechanisms that allow cognitive resources to be freed from them and to enable the information to be adaptively processed so that it can be reattributed to potentially having a source of positive meaning and it being a growth opportunity rather than just completely negative. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so those are the main psychological concepts that they explained mindfulness practices can help with for overcoming stress.
That is so insightful. And I agree, mindfulness should definitely be promoted as a major combatant of stress and a way to deal with your stress responses. Also, purely on a physiological level, we also had an episode about the vagus nerve and about how it allows you to engage your parasympathetic system, and the breathing exercises that you do, it allows you, as you've mentioned, to regain control of your body, of your thoughts, of your environment. Like, it's a really good way to just have that reset and to physiologically calm down your body. And then I also read a few other pieces of advice. So I was really inspired by a talk by Dr. Maria Juarez Reyes. She gave a talk in Stanford and she promoted exercise. Of course, we all know exercise is really good, not only for our general health, but especially for dealing with stress. It kind of does a similar thing of mindfulness in that it counters all of the stress hormones with positive hormones, if you'd like to think about it in that way. And also reduce stimulants. So coffee is a big one. Also sugar. I hadn't realized how much sugar plays a major role in this, not only because it's a stimulant, but also because it's inflammatory. So if you're in a chronic state that you're constantly inflamed, plus you're having sugar, you're going to be even more inflamed, which will also affect other types of diseases associated with chronic stress, such as coronary artery disease, which now there's more research about how it's not only about the plaque buildup, but about the inflammation around the arteries that is dangerous.
Yeah, and linked to sugar, I also read a paper about salt and how they basically fed rodents a high salt diet. And when this was done over a long period of time, they showed it led to increased cortisol dysfunction and the chronic stress responses.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's good to know. And then also yoga. Of course, Clara is a big advocate for yoga. And then Tai Chi, transcendental meditation, Qigong, which is about enhanced movement, life force, and mindfulness. So all of these different practices have different goals and focuses. Some is more on the breath, some is more about relaxation, some is more about movement, some is more about balance. But all of these are really good to engage your parasympathetic system and counter the high levels of cortisol that you have running through your body.
Yeah, I think it's really powerful what we as humans can do in terms of exerting control over our biology in a way. And it's always through this parasympathetic, sympathetic system balance. And I'm also currently reading the book, The Body Keeps the Score, which is a really amazing book about trauma and the body and mind-body interactions. And I think it just really emphasizes in that book how unconscious stress and trauma is, and how it really just puts us into a state where we begin to act unconsciously and automatically to situations, and we form these patterns we just aren't aware of. So I think the ability to then reflect on that, understand how we are approaching situations, and understanding that we have the ability to control how we react to everything is amazing, because it then leads down to the biological effects, and even being able to control like the levels of hormones that are being released by our own brains.
Yes, it's amazing. I think that's a great place to end today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you listen to this episode and you are mindful of your stress responses and what you can do to tackle them. If you liked today's episode, please feel free to share it on your Twitter, Instagram. It means a lot to us. And check out the resources for today's episode on the website, neuroversepod.com.
Thank you for listening.